Alavi for being with us.
Thanks,
thank you,
sister. It was a great pleasure. You referred to Imam Hussein al-Salam. This is the last example that I want to add. How many people wrote letters to Imam Hussein to come? And they knew Imam Hussein well. What did they do when Imam reached Karbala and reached the...
They ditched him. Inshallah, we be among those, what we say, we actually put it into action and we be among the army of Imam, inshallah. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Pollution. Part 2.
We've seen videos and images on the internet with this writing on them. This spot on Earth is a real haven. Lush green forests, beaches with white sands, the water in the sea that's so pure it looks like glass, and a unique wildlife. I mean, somewhere like Borneo in Southeast Asia, an island that's divided between three countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the tiny state of Brunei. When you go to a whopping mall for your daily shopping, when you're sitting in a restaurant to eat dinner, when you wash your hair with shampoo in the bathroom, when you're biting off a piece of chocolate, when you're using cosmetics, and in many other things you do during the day, you're in fact using palm oil. Almost 80 kilograms for each person annually. Now, if we know that 85% of the palm oil in the world comes from Indonesia and Malaysia, we can ask a few important questions. Who's burning the forest? Who's polluting the air? Are the poor farmers in Borneo behind the increased levels of CO2 in the air? Or is it the people who buy and use palm oil every day more than before? During the past 20 years, Malaysia's palm oil exports have increased 1,500 times, and the turnover now stands at over $21 billion. The country is a top producer of palm oil in the world. The world's never-ending demand for palm oil has made the people in Indonesia to break the boundaries. Instead of planting rice and vegetables, despite the hardships and enjoying the beauties of the nature in the country, they've opted for industrial farming of palm trees with a shorter life, but with more amenities. We're talking about $400 of monthly income for a 2-hectare farm with about 400 palm trees. The income isn't considered meager in Southeast Asia. It can tempt anyone.
In many other regions, too, rainforest is being burnt down. 2.6 million hectares have been destroyed, a region almost the size of Belgium. Palm oil companies are responsible for about half the fires laid. Who did this?
They can't find the arsonists, or don't want to find them. But everything here was burnt down, even our fields and houses.
I've lived in London for more than 18 years. I came here from New York. But as much as I've always loved Britain, there was something that bothered me from the start, a thickness to the air, the smell of exhaust that hit me every time I walked outside. It was only years later, when I was working on an article about air quality at the 2012 Olympics, that I sat down to read some of the science of what air pollution does to our bodies and how much of it there is here in London. It only took a few minutes of Googling for me to see that the fumes I dismissed as a nuisance were actually toxic.
There have been numerous similar scandals in recent years. Gardner has highlighted one of them that has to do with Boris Johnson, former UK Prime Minister and London Mayor. According to the research, when Johnson was the Mayor of London, he had gotten dust particle suppressants sprayed around air quality monitors to bring down their readings. These deceptive methods are for advanced countries. In impoverished nations, things are different.
For a long time, we didn't have a choice about relying on fossil fuels, but we don't need them anymore. It's time to move towards something better, toward a future built on clean energy from the wind and the sun, electric cars instead of diesel and petrol, less driving, more walking and cycling. It won't be easy to end the era of fossil fuels. They're woven into the fabric of our societies. And there is a lot of money and a lot of power invested in keeping us dependent on them.
In 1952, 7 years after World War II, countries were seeking to accelerate their production. Factories working at full blast every day. Millions of tons of charcoal were burnt in the world to help the factories keep producing. London was in ruins due to the Second World War. Those days, it was still the biggest city in the world with a population of 8 million people. Almost all of the population and the factories around London used charcoal to supply energy. December 5th, 1952, went down in history forever. In just 4 days, the sulfuric steam claimed 4,000 lives. The figure later rose to 12,000 people. About 100,000 people were infected with various diseases. Officials throughout the United Kingdom introduced a strange strategy to eradicate the mysterious disease. Soon, everyone was talking about offshoring pollution. Today, China is the second largest economy in the world. Many economic analysts believe that the country will take over the U.S. and take the first spot in a few years. The big stride was made thanks to the hard work by millions of laborers in tens of thousands of small and large factories in the country. Everything in the country was developing, even pollution. In Beijing, mothers get up every morning, and first thing in the morning, they go to their children to check if they're still breathing. Preparing breakfast comes next. Everything has to be washed with the water that's purified under the sink. But the water isn't for drinking. They can only drink potable water. That's how a day begins in polluted Beijing. People have to be careful from morning to night. Be careful about the water they drink and the food they eat to make sure they're not polluted. A large population of poor people lives in this city. Living in luxury homes is a dream that will never come true. But when it comes to pollution, people's wealth cannot change anything. According to a survey by Nanjing University, A third of all deaths in China is related to air pollution. The research was carried out in November 2015 on 33 million people in 74 cities in China, and it came to light that 31% of the fatalities are linked to air pollution. The largest number of deaths took place in Hebei province, where Beijing is located and is in the worst condition. In fact, Beijing is made up of two cities, a part of the city where the rich people could enjoy a better air quality and the polluted part where a large number of poor people reside. The rich people live in the cleaner part of the city. On the polluted days, they can go to work in their own cars, have access to better doctors, and have another house in the suburbs to go to and get fresh. Thanks to air purifying machines, the air inside the homes of the richer people in Beijing is purified with more expensive filters. An ordinary purifier costs $4,300 in Beijing. It pumps in the air from the outside and pumps the air into the home after purifying it. But a machine that can completely purify the air and stop carbon dioxide and other pollutants from entering the home with stronger filters costs about $7,200. The filter needs to be changed once a month. Each filter costs $430. A water purification filter costs $300, and the figure can be as high as $1,000. People in Beijing are usually seen with face masks on in the streets. These circumstances have led to the emergence of bizarre products in stores throughout Beijing. For example, a bottle of the UK's air is sold at the exorbitant price of $115. The air that was once the most polluted in the world, but now, thanks to exporting pollution, it is clean. Or at least thanks to the deceptive measure by Boris Johnson, it is passed off as clean. Every year, about 20,000 people in Southeast Asia die due to pollution from burning charcoal. The figure can reach an annual casualty of 70,000 people in 2030. The number of power plants that run on charcoal in Malaysia, as the most populated country in the region after China, has increased to 323 from 147. In Myanmar, we expect to see a five-fold increase, and the current three power plants will increase to 16 charcoal-fueled power plants. Charcoal is inexpensive, and it's pushed even advanced countries like South Korea and Japan to devise plans to establish fossil fuel power plants, especially charcoal. It can make the situation even worse. But the pollution in Indonesia and Vietnam will be worse. Power plants in those countries are fast mushrooming. You'll be even more shocked if you know that 100,000 people die every year in India because of the complications related to the power plants.
By 2021, diesel fuel here will meet European standards. The government has also promised to shut down old coal-fired plants and restrict new ones. But pollution has been worsening for years. The Indian government says it's taken steps to reduce pollution. But in the meantime, for years to come, India's capital, and for that matter, most of its major cities, will continue to be among the most difficult places on Earth to breathe.
China is the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. The country consumes charcoal 40 times more than Indonesia. Only in 2013, 366,000 Chinese lost their lives to bad effects of using charcoal. So why don't the people in China and Southeast Asia do something for themselves to tackle the situation? The answer lies in offshoring pollution. When London and other metropolises in the world face air pollution during the past decades, they came up with a solution. They decided to relocate the factories that cause pollution away from their countries and only manage them from a distance. On paper, the decision would benefit the poorer countries as well, because it would create jobs for them and would transfer technology as well. As a result of the decision, thousands of major and minor companies are operating in Southeast Asia, poor African countries, and Latin America. They can produce anything at the lowest cost compared to advanced countries. The reason is the low cost of production in those countries, inexpensive fuel, inexpensive land, and low wages of manpower. Lack of rules and regulations that work as roadblocks and many other factors in these countries turn them into favorite spots for making products, but their citizens do not benefit from it that much, and the only thing they get in return is air pollution, disease, and a meager amount of money that only keeps them afloat. Agyoblushi is a small but famous region in Accra, the capital of Ghana. This is a terminal ward for many things, from cars, tires, and various machines to television sets and many other electric appliances. Every year, about 215,000 tons of electric appliances are sent to Agyoblushi. Only 30% of them are brand new. The rest are second-hand goods that have to be demolished. In fact, people in Ghana are tasked to ruin these devices at this point. After this phase, the only thing that is left from them is smoke, black smoke that's always there in the sky. It contains carbon dioxide, poisonous gases, and any other pollutant you can think of. Most of these goods are sent from rich countries to Ghana as piles of garbage. People in this country do everything to stay alive and eat. Gutting a clunker is the most honorable job in Ghana. After separating the parts, they put aside the useful parts. When they remove the body and the main components, they reach metals that don't reveal themselves so easily, like copper wires that are hidden under plastic covering. The most common way to reach the precious metal is to burn the wire. After the plastic covering is burned, they collect the remaining metal. This is exactly what happens to computers, cables, and electric appliances in the kitchen. It seems damaging, burning, and collecting the leftovers are a win-win for both sides of the deal. One side of the deal gets rid of the garbage and the environmental hazards caused by it, and those on the other side of the deal can eat a few good meals and keep waiting for the cargo ships arrive that are going to bring in the new piles of garbage. The glamorous world today needs to keep producing goods in order to remain sustainable. The goods are advertised every day on billboards. They're put on display in galleries. Many people are ready to stand in long lines for hours to get them. But producing these goods involves expenses, and producers are always desperate to reduce those expenses. In today's world, there has been a simple division of labor. In part of the world, people work all day long in factories and workshops to supply for other people in other parts of the world. In some parts of the world, people create garbage, and people in other parts of the world burn that garbage. In some parts of the world, people live, and in other parts of the world, people are just trying to stay alive. division of labor is apparently fair based on the slogans, but in practice, something else happens.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, training kids to be confidant. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of training kids to be confidant in the Islamic lifestyle. According to the Islamic teachings, it is necessary that when we raise our kids, we need to train them in a way that they are trustworthy and they raise up as a person who is trustworthy, they raise as a person who is confidant, and he keeps the secrets. And obviously, in order to do that, we need to inform them or we need to tell them about the reasons why people, they leak secrets, they're not trustworthy, and what are the aspects or what are the basic main things due to which these people cannot do that. The very first thing is if a person is talkative. The second thing is if he is showing off. These are the two things. After that, the third thing is the friendship. And this friendship is very important because we should not share everything with the friends, even with the closest friend, we should not share our secrets. We need to tell our kids that if they want to share the things, they should share it in a way that it does not harm them. Because sometimes, you know, the friends, if they are talkative, if they are have a personality of showing off, or if they're not trained well, they can leak the secret, they can tell our secrets to the others. And later, we have to face the consequences. Therefore, this friendship is very important, that we become friends with the people, but we do not share everything with the people. And this is not a bad thing. Obviously, everyone has their own secrets. There are some super secrets that we have, which we do not want anyone to know about it. Therefore, we need to keep it. We need to share it with our God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We can share it with the imam of the time, for example, when we are talking to them. So these secrets, which is not hidden from Allah, we should share it with Allah and no one else, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of training kids to be confident in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that one of the reasons why people, they don't keep the secrets is their friendship. And because they have friends, they think that these friends are sincere to them. Therefore, they share their things. On the other hand, obviously, when we are worried about things, we have friends who comes to us and they say, like, tell us what happened. You can share it with me. You can trust me. That is fine. We can have friends to be trusted. But obviously, we should not share everything. It's for the elders as well, for the kids as well. We need to tell them. We need to train them in a way. We need to educate them to not to share everything. And we have a hadith as well from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in which Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said that do not share all your secrets with your friends, so that if any one of your enemies knew about those secrets through your friend or maybe friend of friend, they cannot harm you. And also, if the friend with whom you are sharing your secrets, if tomorrow he becomes your enemy, he cannot or he should not be able to harm you because of those secrets, using those secrets. So this hadith, this narration basically tells us that everyone should keep their own secrets with them. And if you have something, do not share it with the people. The reason is, for example, let me just give you a small example, that one day the Prophet Moses, alayhi salam, he was passing through a place, and it was a guy came to him and he said that, "You are the prophet of God. Can you go to the God and ask him to forgive me because I have performed this and this and this sins?" So he talks about his sins. And when Musa alayhi salam, he went and he talked to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah said to him that, "Oh Musa, I forgive him. But tell him I have a complaint, that the secrets that he had, which I do not want anyone to know about them, why he shared those secrets with you, you as a prophet. I even hide his secrets from you, but he himself has disclosed his secrets." So this thing teaches us that we need to keep secrets within us, and if there is someone with whom we can share, that is only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. کتاب الله.
in the limelight.
The West's attempts to pressure Africa to turn on Russia have failed as people on the continent realize that the unipolar world order is coming to an end, according to the head of the Russia-Africa Partnership Forum. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Newsweek, Oleg Ozerov, who is also Russia's ambassador at large, said recently that the attendance of 40 out of 54 nations at the Russia-Africa Interparliamentary Conference had shattered the myth of Russia's alleged isolation due to the events in Ukraine persistently promoted in the West. People in Africa understand very well that the former Soviet Republic has turned into an arena of confrontation between the new and the old world paradigms, between different visions of the future. Not just a trivial feud between neighbors, he said. According to the diplomats, the well-balanced and neutral approach towards Russia's confrontation with the West by Africa, China, India, and Latin American nations confirms once again that the transition to multipolar architecture is irreversible. Those countries clearly understand that the time for unipolar world order is running out, he added. What Africa needs now is promotion of local solutions and national interest, as well as deliverance from the rigid constraints of globalism promoted by neoliberalist ideologies, Ozerov said, adding, African countries count on Russia's support in achieving those goals. Moscow is backing efforts to complete the decolonization process in a number of African countries, while also working to put together a broad anti-terrorist front on the continent, free from any hidden agenda or double standards, the diplomat continued. The US and EU want Africa to play the role of a mere supplier of raw materials to the civilized world, Ozerov said. But Russia has a different approach, as its primary interest is to assist the development of Africa's domestic energy and electricity markets, where we have considerable expertise, especially as regards nuclear energy, he explained. Moscow has no vested interest such as to preserve its zone of influence or aggressively guard markets from any outsiders, and Africans see that, the envoy said. And that's the reason why the unprecedented pressure by the West on Russia's partners in Africa is not that effective in practice. Ozerov said that during his trips to the continent, it became obvious to him that the aggressive imposition of Western new values causes growing rejection there and only brings Russia and African countries closer together. Russia is due to host a high-level Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg in July, with the envoy saying that recent developments indicate that the event is going to be a success. Meanwhile, RT reported the West has been hampering the growth of African nations, who are now turning to the East. Bistrat Meles said, Africa is benefiting from the emerging multipolar world in which the continent is building relations with Russia, China, and other BRICS nations. Bistrat Meles, a senior producer and news anchor at Ethiopia's Fana Broadcasting Corporation, has told RT. Meles pointed out, now the time for unipolarism has ended. Now is the time for multipolarism. This multipolarism is great for African nations and an opportunity to tie with Russia, to tie with China, to tie with the whole of the East. Moscow offers cooperation on equal terms to African nations, while the West is executing its own agenda, interfering in internal matters of the Africans, he said. Institutions such as the International Monetary Fund, IMF, the World Bank, which have been active in Africa in recent decades, are the ones executing this agenda of the US and its allies, the journalist believes. According to Meles, the creation of the BRICS group, which unites Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, has opened up an opportunity for the continent to obtain alternative sources of financing and speed up its development, he said. Now China and Russia clearly create the opportunity for African growth.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-ardam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of taqlid or following a religious scholar, a jurisprudential scholar, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but In 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest as speaker. We are talking about the rules of taqlid based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, a follower of a marja, sees that there is another marja who's recognized to be the most learned. What's his duty?
Well, the obligatory precaution in this case is to shift from the marja who is currently being
followed
to the one who is supposed to be the most learned.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, with respect to issues in which their fatwas differ, you know, it's always a matter of, you know, it's agreed that in those matters which the two mujtahids have the same opinion, it does not make any difference as to which one he follows. But in the matters or in the issues in which the fatwas differ, the obligatory precaution is that he should shift, he should move from the marja, from the current marja to the one who is the most qualified mujtahid.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sheikh Tawid, when is it permissible for a follower to change his taqlid to another marja?
Well, according to precaution or ihtiyad, it's not permissible basically to change from a living marja to another living marja or another living mujtahid unless the second mujtahid is more learned and better qualified. Otherwise, there should not be any reason for changing. If the second mujtahid is better qualified, then of course the precaution is to move to that mujtahid and act according to his fatwa, especially in matters that the opinions of the second mujtahid differ with regards to the acts of worship.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how about the difficulty of some of the, for example, laws that are there and they are issued by, for example, their marja that they follow, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to follow them? Or they think that they are not, in accordance with the changing time.
Mm-hmm.
Does it actually make it a good excuse to change one's marja?
Well, this is not a justified or, a reason for changing taqlid. The compatibility of the fatwa with the requirements of the present time is not actually a good reason to shift, and it's not permissible to change from the most learned mujtahid to another mujtahid simply because of the very speculation that his fatwas are not compatible or consistent with the contemporary let's say, circumstances or the ongoing, let's say, developments or the changes that are taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So such an excuse is not, such an, an excuse or let's say reason does not become a license for changing or shifting to another mishtahid.
Mm-hmm. I see. What is it meant by the blameworthy ignorant person?
Well, a blameworthy ignorant person, there's another word which I usually use, and that is culpable, duty-bound person,
mm-hmm.
okay? Someone who is to be, someone who is to blame for not acting according to the fatwa or not fulfilling his duty, such as such a person is will of course be punished in the hereafter because he is blameworthy, he is muqassir, and of course a muqassir, someone who is blameworthy, should actually jump into action and try to act according to the fatwas of the his mujtahid, according to the religious instruction and so on and so forth. He should seek knowledge, he should acquire wisdom, knowledge, information, he should improve his awareness. For example, if you have access to a scholar,
mm-hmm.
and you don't know how to pray, you don't know how to fast, and you have no information whatsoever about the rules of prayer, about the rules of fasting, and the scholar is there, the risala is there are the website is there. So you are muqassir, you are blameworthy because you have all these
facilities available.
You can reach these things and learn something, but you could not do anything. Mm-hmm. So you are blameworthy. You ought to be blamed for not doing anything. So generally speaking, a blameworthy person is a person who realizes his ignorance and knows the possible methods by which he can overcome his ignorance, but deals carelessly and with learning the religious rulings. He does not try to learn those rulings.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll come back with a very interesting question right after the break. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about the rules of taqlid based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, before the break, I asked you about mughassir, a blameworthy, ignorant person. But what about qasir, an unblameworthy, ignorant person?
Yes. Qasir or an inculpable ignorant person is someone who does not have access to things through which he can remove his ignorance, or he's not aware of his ignorance in the first place, and he has no way to get the rule. Like I give you the example of people living in the North Pole, the Eskimos. Who have no knowledge. They even do not know that they are ignorant. There is a religion called Islam. There is, for example, Sharia. And so they are actually inculpable in their ignorance.
Mm.
They will not be punished for not acting, for not praying, for not fasting, because they have no information. They know nothing about prayer, about fasting. Such people are called qasir. Their ignorance is inculpable. And so they are not to blame for not praying, fasting.
Oh, all right. And, you know, Sheikh Sawit, in many of the episodes you talked about precaution, but what about obligatory caution? What does that mean?
Obligatory caution or obligatory precaution is again a precaution that is necessary to abide by, to follow. And it's not, again, I should say, it's not fatwa. It is a precaution that is that one must act upon and must comply with, because it is just a precaution that must be exercised. As long as one is acting according to the precaution in not following the not acting according to the fatwa of another mujtahid, he should comply with it. He should follow it, and that's what precaution, obligatory precaution, actually means.
Sheikh Chawit, there is another phrase which is used in these Islamic laws or books of Islamic laws, such as, for example, there is a problem in it, mentioned in some of the fatwas. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Does that mean prohibition?
Well, you know, it differs from case to case, from one issue to another issue, and from one problem to another problem. If the problem is in permissibility, it indicates prohibition on the practical level, you know. If, for example, someone asks you whether it is let's say shaving beard is permissible or not, and then the mujtahid says there is a problem in shaving beard, so it means that it's not permissible. It is prohibited to shave.
Yes.
Shave the beard. And of course, when you're talking about permissibility and the mujtahid says it is there is problem in it, it means it's not permissible. It's prohibited.
Uh-huh. So what's the difference between impermissible and haram? Is there any difference?
The difference is in the wording. The impermissible and prohibited are the same, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The mujtahid is actually free to choose to use either of these two words.
So they are synonymous.
They are kind of synonymous.
Yes.
And they convey the same thing.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chawit.
Thank you,
my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the team here in the studio, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Alim Malja Ilaha Illa Hum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Samee Basir La Ilaha Illa Hum Rahim محيٍ مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.